Iran's leader slams the U.S. for distorting reality and inverting the truth and claiming to be a supporter of human rights. A study shows that some 6 million jobs were wiped out in EU countries due to the COVID-19 pandemic, with women and young workers being the hardest hit. The number of coronavirus infections in Germany starts to rise again amid warnings about a third wave of the pandemic. Live from our Tehran headquarters, this is World News with me, your host, Behrouz Najaf. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Now, beginning with our top story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, says that the U.S. is inverting the truth by claiming to support human rights while backing those who violate them. Ayatollah Khamenei says that Saudi Arabia has been bombing Yemen for 6 years, and the UN and the U.S. have been silent toward those crimes. He said Washington and the United Nations are prompt enough to condemn the Yemenis when they launch retaliatory attacks against Riyadh. The leader also slammed Washington for building military bases in the region under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Ayatollah Khamenei also slammed the U.S. presence in Syria, arguing that Washington created a military base there without the permission of Damascus. He called for the pullback of American forces from Syria and Iraq. Iran's leader also rejected a U.S. claim that the Islamic Republic's regional presence is destabilizing. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that Iran's regional presence is non-military. He also criticized Washington for having the world's largest nuclear arsenal. Ayatollah Khamenei said that Washington is the only country that has used nuclear weapons, and now it claims that it's against weapons of mass destruction. Political commentator Mohammad Marandi says that Ayatollah Khamenei tried to convey to the audience in his recent remarks that Iran's policies are based on religious and humane principles in support of the oppressed and the deprived.
Basically, my understanding is that he was trying to tell or convey to the audience that the principles that Iran follows are based upon their religious principles, and they are humane principles. And it's not only in support of Muslims or people of our region, but it's the principle is to support the oppressed and the deprived across the world. And the main source of oppression and aggression is, of course, the United States and its allies and proxies across the world. The Western media, their regimes, their think tanks, they create narratives in order to legitimize their horrific policies, in order to legitimize oppression, in order to legitimize colonialism and neocolonialism.
The Iranian foreign minister is warning that the U.S. that persisting in its maximum pressure campaign against Iran won't yield any result. In a Twitter post, Mohammad Javad Zarif said that despite Washington's claim of favoring diplomacy, the new U.S. administration is pursuing the same policies as its predecessor. Zarif says that Iran's assets blocked in South Korea are meant to be used for food and medicine. Now, those comments were made one day after U.S. Secretary of State said that Washington has opposed the release of billions of dollars in Iranian funds from South Korea. Antony Blinken said that the money will only be unfrozen when Iran returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran says it will only reverse its commitments cuts once Washington removes all its unilateral sanctions. Now let's turn to Yemen. The health ministry there says that fuel crisis has forced many health facilities in the capital Sana'a to close some of their sections. It also warned that the hospitals may completely stop functioning if the Saudi-led coalition does not release the captured oil ships. Our correspondent has a report from Sana'a.
Officials for one of the biggest hospitals in Sana'a say the facility is on the brink of closure due to the severe fuel crisis. This is why the Saudi-led coalition is still holding 14 Yemeni oil ships since the beginning of 2021.
So far, we only have fuel for 3 days. After that, all the devices will stop. the intensive care unit, the heart center, and the premature babies incubators, which depend on electrical energy to preserve the lives of patients. These lives will be lost in case the aggression and blockade continue and the Saudis don't allow the oil ships to enter the country.
The Ministry of Health said the fuel shortage has already forced many health facilities to shut down some of their sections and to stop providing health services partially, and they may stop completely if the fuel crisis continues.
We in Kuwait Hospital had to stop the oxygen plant that used to feed the intensive care unit, surgery unit, and premature babies incubators, and ambulances were also stopped. If the aggression and siege continue this way, the hospitals will turn into mass graves, and this is the further killing of the Yemeni people.
An all-out blockade has been imposed by Riyadh since March 2015, when the Saudi-led coalition launched its deadly war campaign on Yemen. The United Nations described the situation and the war-torn country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but failed to take real action to make any difference. It is a matter of days until thousands of patients become deprived of benefiting from the health services of this hospital, unless the international community steps in and pressures Saudi Arabia to release the illegally detained oil tankers. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now, based on a new study, some 6 million jobs were wiped out across the European Union due to the COVID pandemic. The study was carried out by Eurofund, an EU agency dedicated to monitoring living and working conditions in the bloc. According to the report, temporary contractors, females, and young workers are the worst hit. The study says that while teleworking has helped protect jobs, it has also put people into protracted professional inactivity. The bloc's employment levels, that is, during the pandemic, have shrunk more than the 2008 financial crisis, with 17% of workers employed but not working. The number of coronavirus infections in Germany has started to rise again amid warnings about a third wave of the pandemic there. Data of Germany's Robert Koch Institute says that the country recorded nearly 14,400 new cases on Thursday, the highest daily caseload since early February. Lothar Wieler also stressed the importance of observing health protocols like wearing masks and observing social distancing. Wieler expressed hope that a vaccination campaign will turn the tide. Now, those comments came after the government started easing lockdown restrictions in late February. Since the beginning of the pandemic, Germany has recorded over 2.5 million cases and 73,000 deaths. The European Union is getting increasingly defensive of its vaccine rollout process, slammed as sluggish by member states. A fraction of the bloc's population has been vaccinated, as it is facing production and distribution hiccups. New controls on exports have been put in place to prevent doses leaving the EU, as it is scrambling to catch up with the UK and the US and be ready to jumpstart the economy. Jan Karakini reports.
The EU has faced production problems with the Pfizer-BioNTech, Moderna and Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccines, blocking shipments to places like Australia amid shortages. Meanwhile, the European Council has accused the UK of imposing an outright ban on the export of COVID-19 vaccines to the bloc. The UK's Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, has written to set the record straight, saying the claims are false, but the European Council President doesn't seem convinced.
Glad if the UK reaction leads to more transparency and increased exports to EU and third countries. Different ways of imposing bans or restrictions on vaccines and medicines. EU is providing vaccines for its citizens and the rest of the world. No one is safe until everyone is safe.
For many member states, why the EU's vaccine procurement and distribution process is waning does not really matter. They want to stop the dying, reignite their battered economies, and secure election votes. So they're looking elsewhere for supplies. Hungary got its first shipment of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine on the 4th of March, and in just a week has made good on its promise to become one of the bloc's most vaccinated countries. The EU has not approved the Russian jab, but on Tuesday, Moscow signed a deal to produce 10 million doses of Sputnik V in Italy by July.
I believe that this is a historic agreement because it sees Italy as the first in the European context to enter into such an important agreement for the production of Sputnik in Italy.
The retail, entertainment, tourism, and airline industries are desperate to get back on track and mitigate their lockdown losses. But for that to happen, enough people need to be inoculated. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has chided the EU for the slow pace of its vaccine drive. On the other hand, it has forecast a rapid economic recovery for the UK, which has given one in three adults their first dose. The OECD says speed is of the essence and is urging the EU to get on a war footing when it comes to vaccine distribution. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Britain saying it's committed to resolving the Northern Ireland trade issues with the European Union.
I think it's important to protect the integrity of the internal market in the UK. I think it's very important that all sides live up to that commitment. And of course, we are committed to pragmatically resolving any of the outstanding issues in the Joint Committee. And the action we've taken is lawful. It's targeted. It's just to make sure that the commitments to preserve the integrity of trade in the internal market is properly respected.
Dominic Raba made a comment during a press conference in Estonia last week. The EU threatened legal action against Britain after London unilaterally extended a waiver or grace period for checks on food imports to Northern Ireland. Brussels argues the move violates the terms of Britain's divorce deal from the bloc. The UK left the EU single market and customs union under a deal with the bloc in December. Tariff-free trade in goods as well as close police and judicial cooperation also came into force following that agreement. Now, a fugitive Catalan politician has returned to Spain after over 4 years in exile to settle her legal situation. Marichal Serret, a former regional government minister, appeared before the Supreme Court in Madrid for a deposition, and she was released shortly after. She's expected to be summoned for investigations into the 2017 Catalan independence referendum. Serret and some other politicians fled to Belgium shortly after a vote, which the Spanish government deemed as illegal. She's the first politician to return to Spain recently. Her arrival comes days after the EU Parliament decided to strip three of her colleagues of immunity, including former Catalan leader Carles Puigdemont. The Spanish government is expected to attempt to bring them to court. I talked to our correspondent in Barcelona, Cusay Kedri, and he says that the return of fugitive politicians shows a division in Catalonia's pro-independence camp more than ever.
The procedures. But her return is symbolic in two levels. First, it shows that the rift between the two main pro-independence parties is more than ever alive. That is to say, the Catalan separatists who view that the conflict with Spain should be resolved within Spain, more or less, and that is an idea which is backed or represented by Oriol Junqueras, who is in jail, and the other part of the Catalan independence movement, embodied more or less by ex-president Puigdemont, who basically wants to bring the conflict to the European courts, to the world stage, in a more confrontational approach. So this is the first thing to bear in mind. The second is that tomorrow Catalonia starts the constitution of the new parliament. Marichal Serret says that she wants to take an active part in regional politics. That's how she explained her return. It means that we are probably moving to a new chapter with regard to the Catalan-Spanish conflict. It also means that the divisions within the pro-independence camp is becoming increasingly present by the day.
Japan has observed a moment's silence to mark the 10th anniversary of an earthquake and tsunami that devastated the country's northeastern coast, including a nuclear plant. In a ceremony in Tokyo, Emperor Naruhito delivered a speech to the families of the victims. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga also used the occasion to pledge to review his country's disaster prevention policies. He said that he would work to make a country resilient to disaster. People nationwide also held commemoration services. A powerful quake and tsunami in 2011 caused a meltdown in Fukushima nuclear plant, triggering the world's worst nuclear disaster since the 1986 Chernobyl crisis. More than 18,000 people lost their lives in that incident. U.S. warship has once again sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated warnings and criticism from China. The U.S. Navy said that its missile destroyer, USS John Finn, conducted a routine transit through the waterway. The Chinese Army, however, says it resolutely opposes the transit and slammed the move as flaunting. The incident marks the third such voyage through waters separating mainland China and Taiwan since President Joe Biden took office. The United States and some other countries view the route as part of international waters open to all. China regards Taiwan as a breakaway province, but a government in Taipei wants independence. Beijing has long accused Washington of interfering in its internal affairs by acting as Taiwan's main international backer and weapons supplier. Crude prices in India have skyrocketed in recent weeks, putting common man under tremendous pressure. The fuel price has been one of the key poll issues used by opposition parties in the five poll-bound states to corner the ruling BJP. Munawar Zaman, our correspondent, reports from New Delhi.
Crude oil is considered one of the backbones of the Indian economy, and recent months have seen a sharp rise in the crude prices. Petrol prices are at an all-time high in the state of Mumbai, while diesel, the main driver of industrial activity, is being sold for more than 88 rupees a litre, raising transportation costs. The government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi for now has shifted the blame for high prices on previous governments and production cuts by some oil-exporting nations.
Experts say the rising crude prices will put pressure on the country's economy that's heavily dependent on imports and has just recovered from a deep recession following COVID-19 pandemic, which shattered the world economy.
While many experts believe that the government could cut taxes on petrol and diesel ahead of election in five key states, they, however, warn that the persistent higher prices could lead to inflation, which could threaten the path to recovery. They say both state and central government should act swiftly. While the revenues gained from taxes on retail fuel is key for government to boost spending in the economy that exited a real recession, the central bank sees those levies along with elevated crude prices a benefit. But experts say any withdrawal of the easy monetary policies to combat price growth will lead to a spike in borrowing costs, in turn hurting consumption and business activity at a time when millions of Indians are still out of work due to pandemic. Experts say the turmoil in West Asia is also a factor driving oil prices, especially for India, which is import-driven economy. Meanwhile, a new report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development predicts India will be among the large economies most severely hit by the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdown restrictions to combat it. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Shadow World, directed by Johan Grumman Perez. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Tete Kofi, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Shadow World gives you an alarming behind-the-scenes tale of the global arms trade, revealing the complicity of the US and British governments working with corrupt regimes in the world and how this determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democracy, and creates widespread suffering. And in shedding light on how our realities are being constructed, the film also offers a way for audiences to see through this horror in the hopes of creating a better future.
I've got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
The heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed, and it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror,
it's nonsense.
It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
And it destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs, they're like food. Munitions, that's got, you know, sell-by date. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby that BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, won the biggest contract, $10 billion. Quite scarce public resources on this weaponry that we didn't need.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroyed the Middle East, not Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place on screen.
Once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it, it controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary was a very politically charged film and also quite very eye-opening and covers a lot of ground about the global arms industry, which is a trillion-dollar industry. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Shadow World?
Well, it's a very detailed, comprehensive look at the exploration of the arms deal, which seems to rally its audience into political action. I didn't feel that it did anything particularly shattering, but what it did was it kind of crossed the T's and dotted the I's. And then it also tried to be a bit sort of poetic. So you have all these numerous talking heads, but they're peppered with these poetic and melodic extracts from Eduardo Galeano's stories. And in that way, the filmmaker trying to make it somewhat more cinematic because it is a lot to digest.
And of course, it could serve as a comprehensive guide to those who don't know much about this this topic.
No, exactly. It's not quite the idiot's guide to arms deal, but it is very intelligently done, very exquisitely edited, and it does give you sort of a very potted history at the issues behind it.
And Tete, if I could turn to you now, what was your take on this film?
Well, trying to understand the arms industry and actually the way of real politics today without watching this film is like trying to understand Hamlet without a quid sheet. You don't understand the language, you don't understand the idioms, you don't understand the context within which everything is being done, and so you probably won't have comprehension. I found this
film... Of course, that's a lot to ask to squeeze into a 90-odd minute film.
Well, and I always ask myself first, look, did he need 90 minutes? And I think, yes, he did, and he used the 90 minutes extremely well. Because ultimately, for any cinematic experience, I'd walk away with, what was the impact? The impact was, I'm really pleased I had breakfast before I watched this movie, because I felt a little bit dirty after watching it. A little bit like
watching... And why was that?
Yeah. Because all of it was so kind of resonant with me of why things are in the world they are today. And it's happening in broad daylight.
And of course,
course, you were saying how there were talking heads in this, but they weren't just any talking heads. They were very high-profile interviews. You had top journalists like Robert Fisk, senior American politicians.
Yes, and you also had that arms dealer, which apparently was very difficult to get hold of an arms dealer to come onto the film, because the director said that the first rough cut was 4.5 hours long, and he'd interviewed 50 people and kind of condensed it to 15. But with people like the arms dealer, it kind of adds more, it adds colour, because at the end of the day, they are just talking heads.
I mean, at the beginning, what absolutely got me bolt upright was a banal statement like, actually, when you're doing an arms deal, your secretary's ass could give you the edge. Then later on in the clip you showed, where he said that politicians are like prostitutes, it's just that they're a little bit more expensive. It's the banality of that world which actually ordinary people in the street cannot believe can be happening in the world of multi-million dollar corporations and the heads of state who we voted to put in place.
So Shadow World's an apt name indeed for the documentary. But we'll just have to move swiftly on just for now.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores.
Cheney commissioned the study by Halliburton to find out how much more of the Defense Department could be privatized.
Halliburton, proud to serve our troops.
Halliburton was elated to get this million-dollar contract and, of course, returned a verdict that, oh, Mr. Secretary, lots more of it can be privatized.
Dick Cheney leaves the Defense Department and goes and heads Halliburton himself. And he spends the entire 1990s building up the Halliburton war empire.
Well, if we're going to talk about Star Wars, we might as well invite Darth Vader. And I'm happy to accept.
Then he comes back into power as vice president, and then they start hiring Halliburton to, you know, in advance even of U.S. troops going into Iraq, Halliburton personnel and equipment was being deployed to the Gulf. It's hard to look at this and not say these guys had a very long-term plan for how they were going to increase the powerful infrastructure of private companies. What we've essentially done is to create a network of corporations that have the firepower of small nation states that could, you know, overthrow some small governments around the world.
In essence, we in the United States have privatized the ultimate public function, war.
Really, you believe there's no such thing as coincidences. Maria, what was your reaction to the connections being made between the U.S. military, the government, and oil companies, and what else does the documentary suggest about the ulterior motives of the government?
Well, part of me was shocked. Part of me was resigned to this hideous, dark shadow world as it's described, and that we have no power to do anything about it because all this is done behind closed doors, you know. It's all about sweeteners and kickbacks. And as it said in the film, that war is a commodity. And it doesn't matter how many people die, the longer that lasts, the more money people make, whether it be at the top of government or, you know, these arms dealers. It's disgusting. It's appalling. And you do feel dirty afterwards, but you kind of feel powerless. And the film doesn't really give you an alternative.
Perhaps there is no alternative in real life there.
Yeah, maybe not. Of course, now with the Trump administration, we would hope that there isn't that secrecy because he does everything via Twitter and he make, you know, we have the biggest arms deal. I'm putting that in inverted commas because he hasn't said that. But, you know, back in the Reagan era and Thatcher and all of those, it was all done secretively.
Which is highlighted in the documentary.
Yeah, and even up to Obama, which that was quite surprising, but not because it's government, so they can do whatever they want, really.
And Tete, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Maria said, and what did you make of these connections being made?
Very much. I mean, I split the movie, the doc, into three parts. Part one was the arrant vulgarity and banality of it with the arms dealer making those statements about politicians and prostitutes, things like that. The bit where they showed a whole Saudi sultan being given a commercial airliner, and the banality of him painting it in his favourite American football colours. I mean, if I was a Man U supporter, I'd have liveried it up in red, for example. Then the second part is that it goes into the culture and the rationales which are given to enable this to happen, and the institutions that support that culture, which is what we've just basically watched. Now, I could not help but expand this documentary into history, and I place at the start point towards the civilization we have now reached at the start of the transatlantic slave trade, because this was the first time an activity, slavery, has been known since the dawn of civilization, but this was the first time it was actually industrialized. Mm-hmm. And with the industrialization, you had to create a philosophy and a culture which enabled it to go on, fly in plain sight with the support of ordinary people. And this is the bit that this documentary does so extremely well.
Well, that's a fascinating point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move swiftly on, and we'll pick up your next point in the next part of the discussion.
I denounced the call to invade Iraq publicly. The New York Times issued me a formal written reprimand, which is what you get before you're fired under union rules to stop speaking out against the war. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief. I mean, I'd been in Iraq, been 7 years in the Middle East. How can you come out of Gaza and not be angry? What's being done to those people? How can you come out of the Sudan, El Salvador, dozens of other places I've been, and not be angry? I've seen the bodies of a lot of children, which I can't forget. Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love, and that's what kills people. I fully get why people blow their brains out. It's really hell. And I don't use love as a kind of hallmark schmaltzy, we all gotta love each other. I'm saying that the only way you're healed from those experiences is by reestablishing a connection with that kind of power, with another human being. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. And I have friends who couldn't do it, and they're not here anymore.
Very emotional account there. Maria, do you get a sense from this documentary that there is a lot of frustration and a lack of support for these ongoing wars?
Well, there is, but the problem is, and what the governments do so insidiously, is to instill terror and fear into the populace. And so that gives them carte blanche to do what they want militarily. And so people sort of believe what the government tells them. And so we're in this vicious circle that correspondents, brave correspondents, like you've just seen, try to get the truth out there. And they're literally, smacked down. And they try to gag them. Mm-hmm. And that's appalling. And it shouldn't happen, but it does. And it's still happening today. Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me, actually, Claire Short, former Labour politician, she says that the war on terror is sort of almost like a manufactured concept to keep this sort of perpetual wars, and it's sort of used as a scapegoat. Would you agree with that,
Tiffany? Well, a marketing man's dream is a product that creates demand for itself. It becomes a perpetual motion machine, and you can't stop it. And I call this part of the documentary the state capture bit. That's the expression we actually use in South Africa for when private people latch onto the state and leech off it. Because that's what's happened with the arms companies and their lobbyists, is that actually they are running the state. And that's why that arms dealer can say that the politicians don't run anything. They're just more expensive than prostitutes. It's the banality of that. And I think that at the end, this documentary works because of the sense of outrage. It can fire up in people. some people will also just feel, what's the point? I give up. We don't stand a chance. But many, many people will be outraged just by being able to join the dots of the fact that these private contractors have got a stranglehold on government. And actually what government does is as a result of what is profitable to the contractor. And some of the governments, of course, people are corrupt. Imagine the ANC taking that massive...
African National Congress.
Yeah. Taking that massive kickback when hundreds of thousands of poor, ordinary Africans' lives could have been saved with retroviral drugs. But they went for that because the ANC wanted to stay there.
Well, going back to the documentary and a really fascinating point you made, there's four main targets, I suppose, of the documentary seems to be the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. How are the four countries portrayed in this documentary, Maria, and how are they connected?
Well, they're not portrayed terribly well, really, because they're in it for the money. You've seen Blair, who brought in new Labour and was, the spiritual light here who's going to bring all this hope. And yet, you know, he was in it for the money. He was getting, kickbacks and stuff, allegedly. But what was interesting there is that the influence that the Saudi royal family had on him, and where you have Prince Bandar come over and say, hold on, the serious fraud...
Serious fraud office, I believe.
Having this investigation into these crimes, and they were getting very close to him. And he said, no, you need to stop this. Otherwise, we're going to remove the security, and there's going to be blood on the streets of London. And then you have Blair turning round, and basically the guy says, jump. And Blair says, well, how high, more or less? That's disgusting, really.
And he
got away with it. But then he was, Teflon Tony, nothing stuck to him. And it's the same with all the other countries. You know, what surprised me was that they didn't look at the drone warfare, and also cyber warfare, which is now becoming...
The documentaries in their own right.
Exactly, and we've probably covered that already. But the thing is that all these countries, nothing kind of surprised me about it, that they were all interlinked. They don't come out very well from the documentary, and if you didn't think well of them, then it will compound what you thought. It's speaking to the converted, really.
Well, this takes us to a really good, great point. We're just going to move on again.
Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other.
$1 trillion bills stacked high would reach nearly 68,000 miles into space, one-third of the way to the moon.
I got a phone call from the FBI saying that I was a target of a death threat. And that's what happens when you go against the big boys.
Who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
There are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that corporations can get out of the penalty box, if you will.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
I've forgotten what the second question was.
Individuals operating in the shadows and never having their names called are able to leverage the power of the military and the foreign policy apparatus for their own personal pecuniary ends.
What now? Who's the enemy? How do we justify all these tanks, all these planes, all this bullshit?
What better new enemy than an hypothetical, invisible enemy called the War on Terror?
Rumsfeld looked quite smug and incompetent then. Maria, I heard you laugh. Why was that?
Because he wasn't incompetent. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew he could get away with it. And he has, And that poor woman was the one that was then ostracized and found it very difficult later on in her career. So these people get away with it. That's the problem. And it's wrong. But what can you do? What can we do?
And Tete, would you agree with Maria? How do you think of... how Rumsfeld was portrayed in this documentary, and was it accurate depiction?
Funny thing, when I was watching it, I actually thought it took me back to one of the scenes in the Godfather movies when the mafia bosses are lined up in front of a, I think it was a grand jury or a commission of some sort, and the smugness with which they behave literally said that whoever's asking the questions, I own your boss. So, and it's the confidence of knowing that they could, he could pull her leash in at any time that he wanted, and sure enough, she's got death threats by the FBI. Whether they're true or false, it's almost lethal pressure to make sure that these people comply. It's extremely difficult, but I actually feel that you can over-egg the pudding to a point. And with the confluence of certain events in world affairs, the nationalism that's rising in Europe, Brexit that's happened in Britain, Trump and all the excesses that he is associated with, I think, actually, we have reached a turning point in which many of these old ways will not be able to function in the way they did before.
So this documentary raises greater and greater questions and makes us question society. Do you think this is a testament to the documentary, then, Maria?
I think so. Like I said earlier, it doesn't really reveal anything new, but
it's certainly thought-provoking.
But it's thought-provoking, and it makes you think, and it kind of joins all the dots, basically, because we knew all this. But when you see it there in black and white or in colour, it's slightly different, and it does make you really angry. You know, you end up screaming at the screen because it's so frustrating that these people, on the face of it, got away with it. And
sorry, just your final thoughts on the film?
But you see, the interesting thing is that there is another documentary that follows this, which will have to put the last piece of the jigsaw in place, which is that actually our collective standard of living is built on the excesses we're seeing in this movie. And it is, I think, when that story is told, that people will connect the fact that actually there isn't so much of an otherness around somebody who behaves like a gangster in creating public policy, and the car that I'm driving on the street, and the fact that my salary is what it is. All of this thing has a cyclical kind of connection, and people will start to join those dots as well.
Ruth, very powerful note to end it on. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there as we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you both to my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Muhammad Mahmoud Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Salam alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, welcome once again to yet another episode of The Bridge, a program in which we try to discuss the different supplications of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, supplications that have come in the form of a prayer manual known as As-Sahifatu As-Sajjadiyah. We have been discussing the seventh supplication of this prayer manual, and that is the supplication of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam during incidents of sorrow, painful occasions, and intense grief. We were discussing verse number 9 of this beautiful supplication, where Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam says, وَلَا تَشْغَلْنِي بِالْإِهْتِمَامِ عَنْ تَعَاهُدِ فُرُوضِكَ وَاسْتِعْمَالِ سُنَّتِكَ. Do not preoccupy me through worry from observing your obligations and acting according to your tradition. Here we mentioned 2-3 important points that I would like to re-mention so that we know what we are talking about. One of the things that we mentioned is that here we are asking Allah, do not preoccupy me through worry from observing your obligations. That means even the worry that we get and the situation that we are in that preoccupies us from obligations and tradition of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this itself is by the consent of Allah. If Allah does not permit this to happen, then that would not happen. It would make, for example, Allah does not want this person to get worried. He would create and facilitate such a thing for him that would make him happy, and thereby he would continue, for example, his obligatory deeds and so on. So by asking this, you are actually asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for assistance, and also you are confessing the fact that it is the ontological permission of Allah that you are in this position. If Allah did not want, then you would have been in another position, and therefore you are asking Allah, please do not make me in this state. Everything is in your hands. This was point number one. Point number two that we mentioned and stressed is that this obligatory deeds that a person can be hampered from are deeds that benefit the human being himself. And not only that, but they are those deeds that make him very high near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He has made them obligatory on his servant, and therefore he makes the servant go very high and close to his proximity, and therefore we should not take it very light. This was point number two.
Rabbana,
a path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds,
the bridge between Allah and his creation,
a bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to his proximity, a bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu As-Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana, Rabbana.
Three today that we would like to stress in this program is the fact that when a person is hampered from performing obligatory deeds as well as the sunnah that we say and acting according to your tradition, this is a very great calamity that has befallen the person. In fact, the calamity that preoccupies him is a muqaddimah, is just an introductory phase of the real calamity, and that is this, that a person is preoccupied from doing the right things, from performing what Allah has legislated, because that would make his spiritual downfall and perhaps eternal damnation, who knows. So if a person is not careful and he takes things lightly, then he would have very many problems. So as the supplicant is asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, his volition and resolution should be so powerful that he makes himself committed that whatever happens, whatever the circumstances, oh Allah, I am going to worship you even more than what I worshipped before. And I'm going to adhere to your laws, and I believe that you are going to make a breakthrough, an opening for me. out of all these difficulties that I'm facing. Now, observe that this needs a kind of knowledge, a prior knowledge that a person should have in order to come to this level. Because if a person does not have knowledge of the reality, that everything is in Allah's hands, every moment, and that it is in His hands that, you know, He can make a person happy or a person sad, or whatever circumstance, He can change the circumstance. If this thing is there in a person's mind and heart and he believes in it, after having conviction about it, you'll find that he will be able to do what is necessary. But if a person, unfortunately, due to the sins that he has committed, or the wrong, the haram or unlawful sustenance that he has eaten, or other reasons that hamper the person, if he has done all these things, there is a possibility that he does not even care about the obligatory deeds. You will find, and this has, you know, these are live examples that you can find in different places, that perhaps a person's family is in so much problem, but yet they don't pray, they don't fast, they don't do the obligatory deeds. And when you ask them, they give you petty reasons. For example, if you ask them, why are you not praying? They say, I'm najis. I'm not praying because I'm najis. They do not make themselves clean, and they do not purify themselves. And they continue with these lame excuses. The reason is that they don't want to do these actions. Why? Because they say, you know, God has done this to me. Sometimes it's, you know, not disbelief. It is belief, but with a kind of ignorance and with a kind of, you know, unfortunately, hatred that stems from ignorance. You will find there are circumstances of people who believe in Allah, who have performed the obligatory deeds, but as soon as they come and they are faced with calamities, it hampers them from doing the obligatory deeds.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So what is important for us is to know that if a person does not perform obligatory deeds, then actually he is preparing his eternal damnation in the hereafter, which is an eternal world. Now, just imagine, sometimes, you know, you are preparing for a journey, let's say. The journey is a limited journey. So you prepare for it and go for the limited journey. Perhaps you are not very successful, and because of that, you face problems in that journey. But here we are talking of an eternal journey. Therefore, for eternity, we have to be ready, as the great scholars have now and again emphasized. Inshallah, we'll continue with our program in our next session. We come to the end of the program. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa alihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin al-ma'sumin.
That was the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Hargez nagirat to abad aqa kasi jay to ra hargez makhad az kaf daham عشق و تولای تو را
یا سجاد.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.